Okay, welcome all. We're just coming up on 7:30, so I'm going to go ahead and mute all. You will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a question or comment. Please remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the presentation deck, the audio track, and the contents of the chat window will go up on our website, courtesy of the hard work of Alan. And we have quite a few items on the agenda tonight, so I'll kick it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Chris. We're going to start off with a quick share on something I came across just today. Basically, using Excel, and this is the 365 version, and by default, it seems to have autosave turned on, and that is in the kind of well, it has autosave on the ribbon. It may not be turned on, but it's on the ribbon, and it's kind of in the top left-hand corner there. So I'm playing around with my spreadsheet, and I'm working on macros, and I've got three workbooks on the go and 20,000 records to play with. And I keep trying to switch between workbooks by clicking on the title bars, and somehow I managed to turn autosave on, and then it started saving files all over the place, or multiple files, and sticking them into a OneDrive folder. And then my Excel menu was filling up with files that I didn't really want. So I looked up how to get rid of it. And basically, if you want to disable autosave on the ribbon, you go to the file menu, select options, and then go down to quick access toolbar, which is that top menu thing, and find turn autosave on and off. That's one of the options in the right hand column of things. And then you hit remove in the center, and that gets rid of autosave off the ribbon and solves all my problems.
Question, Alan. That takes off the ability to toggle it. Do you have to first off make sure autosave is turned off and then take it off the toolbar?
Oh, I've no idea. I don't use autosave, so my problem was I turned it on when I didn't want it.
Yeah.
So that was a way to just get rid of it off, turn it off, and then get rid of it off the toolbar, and then it's not a problem for me.
Yeah, I think it might be important to turn it off first and then turn off the option to toggle it on or off.
Oh, yes, that would be true. You wouldn't want it left on.
Yeah.
Very true, yeah. Sorry, I see what you're getting at. Okay, next up we have a share from Stuart, and he found he likes watching Android Authority videos and found that an item that talks about using AI in YouTube videos to basically spread malware. So his point is that whether that's right or wrong, he's not. He doesn't think you should be using links in YouTube videos. And just like governments and banks should be telling us to ignore their email links and go to websites on our own, maybe you should do the same thing with YouTube and just use the link and enter it directly into the browser to get that. Okay, Chris has got an item here, computer basics item on restarting computers.
Yeah, so this came about because of helping somebody who they had a problem with the mouse not responding. And first thing they did, tried unplugging and plugging it back in. That didn't help. And they figured the next option up was to reboot. But, you know, the question comes, how do you do a reboot if you can't use the mouse too? And next. First you click start with the mouse, of course. Then you click power again with the mouse. Then you click restart. And so what this person ended up having to do was just powering the computer off and back on again, which is not the best thing to do. So you're really best to always do a proper shutdown. Usually Windows will recover okay, but it's not the best way to shut down your computer unless that's your only option to do so. Next. So the question comes up with keyboard operations, and these apply to, I'm going to go through it for actually restarting your computer, but in many applications, you can actually use the keyboard rather than the mouse to do most of the operations within the program. So to do this restart on your computer, you hit the Windows key as used to, it'll open up the Start menu. You can use the Tab key to move within various regions within the Start menu. The arrow keys will move between items within a given region that you happen to be in. And then the Enter key will actually activate whatever is currently highlighted within that region that you are in within the Start menu. And one thing of note, the screenshots that I have in this are all Windows 10 screenshots. Windows 11 regions are defined differently. Just know that you can use the Tab key to move to get to the right region in order to highlight the correct icons. Next. So the first thing you do is you press the Windows key, and that opens up the Start menu. Next. And then you press the Tab key once, which I said Tab moves between different regions within a particular application or window. And in this case, it'll go to a white box highlighting the currently selected item within that region. So in this case, it actually goes to the hamburger menu at the top of the left-hand bar of icons that you have in there. Next. So then you use the arrow keys to move within the region. And so as you arrow down, that white box will go from icon to icon through that particular area of the Start menu. So you go arrow down to the power icon. Next. And then you hit Enter, and that will activate that particular item, which is the power option. Next. And then you arrow down to where it goes to restart, and then you hit Enter to restart the computer. So this is, you know, how you can navigate things even though you don't have a working mouse, which can come up surprisingly often that you want to use keyboard rather than the mouse. And as I mentioned, it happens within most programs. You can use the keyboard rather than clicking around with your mouse. Not a bad idea to familiarize yourself with how to get around your computer without using the mouse. And that's all I have for that.
So Tom has put Tom's put a thing in the chat window, and of course everybody's putting stuff in, so it's moving around. He says pressing the power button briefly usually gives you a graceful shutdown. I think you have to hold the power down to shut it down, do you not?
Well, if you hold it down for at least 4 seconds, usually that'll force a shutdown. And basically an impolite shutdown. So it will just, after 4 seconds, remove the power. And so everything just powers off. So I take it from Tom's statement that just hit it briefly and then it will do a polite shutdown on the computer rather than a forced shutdown.
And Micheline says that she uses the Windows key plus X and then X and then U and then U. And Tom says sequences of Alt and Function key and Enter work too, Alt and F4. So I don't use any of those, so for what it's worth, there are some suggestions for you.
Yeah, Alt F4 is it'll shut down your currently active application is what Alt F4 normally does. And I guess if you don't have any application window open on the screen, then the Alt F4 would effectively be shutting down Explorer.exe, which is the shell, causing a shutdown, I guess. But I'm kind of surprised that actually does that, because Alt F4, if you shut down Explorer.exe, which runs the desktop, it can't operate in Windows without the shell, and so it'll just restart the shell normally. So I'm kind of surprised that actually works. Interesting.
And Jeff says, what about Windows key plus R for run?
Yep.
And then just enter shutdown.
Yep. That'd be another way, I guess, to do it, yeah.
And Harvey says, Control Alt Delete, and yep, then the power button on the bottom right.
Yeah, but again, you might have to tab to it or arrow to it. I'm not sure. But yeah, usually the whole idea is that combination of tab keys and arrow keys will usually move you around within various application windows and things like that. So, yeah, lots of options.
Lots of options, lots of ideas. So if anybody wants to check all those out and do a follow-up next week and tell us what works and what doesn't, then that'll be great. Okay, moving along, we've got Bob Walker, who's going to be talking about follow-up on surge protectors. And I think Bob is going to share his screen.
Yeah, I'm sharing it here. Let me see how we do. Everybody see my full screen there?
Yep.
Chris?
Yep.
Okay, good. A few weeks ago, during one of the Q&A sessions, there was a couple of questions asked on surge protectors. And Chris asked if anybody wanted to volunteer to do a little presentation on it. And I foolishly agreed to that. So here we are. Let me just clear this here. Okay. So a surge protector protects against electrical devices, protects your electrical devices from voltage spikes on the power line. A voltage spike is... In this sense is a transient event that typically lasts from 1 to 30 microseconds, and it may reach over 1,000 volts or more. Among other things, surges can be caused by power failures, and the surge that you get on the power line when the power goes off can often be larger than the surge when the power comes back on. There's power winkies, which are very short power dips. And I live out in the country. I get these all the time. There's lightning hits on the power line. Now, if the power line, right near you gets hit, well, you're pretty much toast. But the lightning hit can be literally hundreds of kilometers away on large power grids like Ontario's. And, I can only give you the a short blip there. So there's solar flare activity, and I've given some talks on renewable energy and the grid and everything, and learned that the longer the power transmission lines, the more susceptible they are to solar activity. And we started to realize this in the 1950s when large power stations were built like Niagara Falls and Robert Saunders, and people hundreds of miles or kilometers away would have problems when there any kind of solar activity happened. And another thing is that major electrical equipment in your own home, like your dryers, stoves, water heaters, can generate minor surges as they turn on and off. And I remember when I was a kid, we'd have our old black and white TV there. And every time the furnace turned on and off, the picture would get a little bit smaller and a little bit bigger again. Now, even modest spikes can destroy a wide variety of electronic devices, including computers, battery chargers, modems, TVs, etc., that happen to be plugged in at the time. They don't have to be turned on. They just have to be plugged in. Typically, the surge device will trigger at a set voltage, usually around 3 to 4 times the mains voltage, and divert this excess power to ground. Now, they're generally rated according to the amount of energy in joules they can absorb, but this rating isn't consistent. You can use it to make a value judgment on the different devices by a set company, but the rating criteria aren't universally agreed to. So it's sort of hit and miss on this. Now, surge protectors don't last forever. Most estimates put the average lifespan of a surge protector at 3 to 5 years. Now, if your home is subjected to frequent brownouts or blackouts, You may want to replace your surge protector as often as every 2 years or even more. The surge protection and components inside wear out a little bit more with each surge, and there's virtually no way to know how much protection remains unless the device happens to include a warning light. Many cheap surge protectors continue to pass the power to their outlets even after the protection is long gone. And that's why you should look for a surge protector with an auto shutoff feature, which stops the device from conveying power when the protection wears out. Now, some surge protectors come with surge protection for power lines, coaxial cables like your satellite TV or your cable TV or whatever, or your cable internet built into them. Some also come with USB charging ports. And besides the surge protectors built into power bars and such, you can get a whole house surge protector that is wired into your electrical panel. Now, in this case, unless you really know what you're doing, it's best to have an electrician install these. And the big caveat with surge protectors is you get what you pay for. You buy a power bar at Canadian Tire for $15 that includes four USB outlets and everything else. If you're depending on that for your surge protection, good luck on that. Likewise, if you're using any power bars or extension cords or power taps or those outlets that you plug into your normal outlet and get six outlets out from the dollar store, virtually none of these are UL or CSE approved, and any surge protection is a myth. Now, there's a great review of premium surge protectors at the URL listed there, and I'm sure Chris is going to feed these all into the chat.
Already done.
Yeah. This is from a website called Wirecutter. Wirecutter has reviews on all sorts of products. They're not quite like Consumers Reports or something like that. They generally tend to review the more premium products. They're owned by the New York Times. And I've bought several items because of reviews at Wirecutter, which really help. And I'd like to thank my friend and a friend of the club, Bob Harris, for turning me on to this particular site. If you want even more info on surge protectors, not specific ones, but generally what they are and how they work and everything, you can go to the Wikipedia URL there. And on a very closely related topic, there's a review of the best travel and power strips and surge protectors with USB charging at the URL listed there. So if you travel a lot and you want some protection when you're on the road, and you also need to charge up your USB devices, that's a great review right there. Now, many surge protectors are sold with connected equipment insurance coverage. But you'll have to jump through a lot of hoops to collect in the event of a disaster. And really, really good luck with that if you ever come across that problem. Now, if you want actual real protection you can count on, you don't get it from the manufacturer. Just make sure your insurance policy covers all that. And there's some do's and don'ts with surge protectors. Always replace your surge protectors after any large event, such as a lightning strike just down the block or multiple outages in rapid succession. a few years ago, I had a lightning strike nearby me on the grid there, probably just a few blocks away. It fried a really nice TV, fried the control board for my garage door opener, and knocked up my landline phone line so badly that it took Bell a few weeks to get it fixed, and they had to send their Jedi Masters from central office down to get it sorted out, in which case they found the entire Bell grid in my area was installed wrong in the early 1950s. Don't plug appliances like toasters, kettles, coffee makers, space heaters, hair dryers, anything that has a really high current into a surge protector. They use a lot of power. They increase your chances of overloading the outlet. And a surge protector adds even more resistance to that power chain and can allow heat buildup and potentially catching fire or damaging the device. And never cover up any part of the surge protector or any of your extension cords with rugs, poofs, or other decorative items, no matter how ugly your surge protector is. This type of direct contact prevents any heat from escaping, and that could start a failure or a fire. Now, if you really want to protect equipment that could be damaged by a sudden loss of power, such as a hard disk drive that's susceptible to data corruption, or critical gear that can't ever go down, such as a CPAP machine, a ventilator for breathing and all that, or an oxygen generator, you shouldn't be looking at a surge protector at all. Instead, you need an uninterruptible power supply or a UPS, and most of these have built-in surge protection. And I'll be covering UPSs in a future session. And that's it for today.
We had some comments on that in the chat. Timothy mentioned that there may be a big solar flare hitting us on Friday this week. So if you don't have something, you might want to unplug equipment if you're going to be not around using it. Tom mentions that cruise ships do not allow surge protectors. I think they've had some fires because of it. And he also mentions, as you did, that UPSs usually include surge protection on it. He says that it's usually motors in your home make your power freaky. Harvey says another option for protecting is use battery backed up UPS, which you mentioned, Bob. Tom asks, can you use sequence surge protectors for a better defense? What do you think of that?
Okay. Generally speaking, sequencing surge protectors don't give you any extra protection. Depends on the best one of the chain to handle the event, and none of the rest really do anything. So if you go to that review article on surge protectors at Wirecutter, they also warn you against that, and they warn you against plugging a surge protector into an extension cord. Generally, if you're not far away from the outlet that you need to use an extension cord, there are some of the premium surge protectors that come with a long cord built in, and that's a better way to do it. Let's see, what was the other comments here?
That was most of them. I think that there is another one that just say Tom says UPSs usually have lead acid batteries. They need replacing every couple of years. And I think that's it for the comments.
Yeah, I have actually two UPSs right now, and both of them come with lithium ion battery packs. So that said, the lithium ion battery packs only last a finite amount of time as well and need to be replaced. One other comment on the anything that handles power is Amazon Basics is a line of products from Amazon that fulfill basic requirements for all sorts of things. And I've used Amazon Basics products successfully for everything from laptop bags to other things. But stay away from any Amazon Basics products that handle power. They've had a number of them down in the States that they've been forced to recall because of fires, and yet they're still available on the Amazon website for whatever reason. So you should really stay away from the same as dollar store items that handle power. Stay away from Amazon Basics products that handle any power.
We have a question from Natalie. You mentioned lifespan. How do you know if it's still effective? And to follow up on that, I guess, is there a way to know how many joules a protector covers when it's not written on it?
Well, like I said, the number of joules it covers goes from company to company because there's no standardized way of saying this. And the only way you can know for sure that the protection is worn out is some of the surge protectors have a status light that will come on and warn you when the protection is worn out. And some will actually, when the protection is worn out, cut the power to the devices that are plugged into it. And some, of course, have both. So those are the only two things. And, of course, the cheaper the surge protector you have, the less likely it is to have either of those two features.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot, Bob. I think that covers off everything that's in the chat.
Okay. And so moving along, we've got an item here on and calculator for mobile data, which came from Stuart, but Chris is going to tell us all about it.
Yeah, Stuart posted this to the member forum, and I checked it out and thought it was pretty cool. So as he described it in the member forum, an extremely simple bandwidth usage estimator, which will let you figure out what your needs are for a given mobile plan. And I thought this was interesting because of the idea that I think most people, when you sign up for a mobile plan, that is a question you sort of ask. Like, you know, they, of course, want to sell you, you know, unlimited or 20 gigs or something like that. And, of course, it's more expensive than if you buy a 10 gig or a 5 gig plan. And so the question really comes up, what do you really need? And, you know, like it tends to get really expensive if you go over your plan. So this mobile data calculator will help you sort of figure it out. So next. So it's as simple as, I say, 1, 2, 3. So you go to the site, and the first thing you do is you select what data allowance or plan size is it that you want. You click on that, and it comes up with everything from, 100 megabytes, down to 1 megabyte. And so you just select what you want there. Next.
100 meg to 10 gig, right?
Oh, 10 gigs, yeah, sorry. Yeah. And then you select what it is you want to analyze as to what this bandwidth would actually provide for you, what sort of activity. Next. And then you hit on the calculate button, and it'll come up with something for you. So just a couple of examples that I went in and did. So on a 3 gigabyte plan, you could spend 133 hours surfing the web, and they make a certain assumption, and they tell you what it is. And so if you do a lot of web surfing, you might say, is that going to be enough for me, considering that that's only one thing you're going to use it for. So next. So you could go back in. You could say, okay, if I have 1 gig plan, how many emails can I handle? And you can do 34,133 emails, you know, again, a certain assumption being made. And next. And if you have a 5 gig plan and you're streaming music from Spotify, you could do 1,280 tracks of music. So I think it's just something that'll help people to sort of gauge by going in, playing a whole bunch of what-if scenarios on what sort of data plan they actually need. So kind of fun.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Another question we had last week was about EULAs. And Karen said, when you install an app, you usually have to agree to the terms, but there are gazillions of pages. And it's really difficult, almost impossible, which I agree with, to carefully review all of the text. So basically, what should you be looking at? So just a bit of background here on EULAs is an end user license agreement, but there's also things like terms of service for websites, for example, and privacy policies, and they all come with a huge document typically that you have to read. EULAs generally apply to the software that you buy, the applications, and typically you don't own the software. You buy it, but you don't own it. You basically purchase the right to use the software. And the EULA, or the terms of service, they basically establish what rights you have and what restrictions there are on how you use the software. And basically that means there's lots of restrictions. Now, to be fair, the people who develop software, they're trying to retain control of the work that they've done, their so-called intellectual property. So they're trying to maintain their copyright, because it's all copy protected by copyright, and they try to stop people reverse engineering their software and building the same mousetrap or building a better mousetrap based on their technology. But the bottom line is that the EULA essentially protects the vendor, the copyright holder, and it doesn't protect the end user, typically. And as Karen noted, the documents themselves can be really long. So everybody looks at the bottom right-hand corner of the window and it says, I agree. So they click there and they don't actually read the terms and conditions. And it turns out, as we'll find out in a few slides, some of the terms can be really quite interesting. And here's an article, web posting from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And this lady has basically outlined the major things that she says are of concern. Or some of the interesting stuff, I guess. I like this first one there. Don't criticize this product publicly. So if you agree to the terms, you're not allowed to say that Microsoft Office is a load of rubbish on every website that you come across, because you just agreed not to do that. And using the product means you'll be monitored. Well, there's all kinds of ways that they try and grab data from what you're doing. There's the don't reverse engineer this product requirement. I like this one too. Don't use this product with other vendors' products. And typically what they're looking at there is they don't want you to benchmark their program with somebody else's software and find out that it doesn't work as well as something else. So they include a term, a condition, to say that you won't do that. And this one's a good one. Yeah, you agree to every change in future versions. And so you read, if you go through all the paperwork and you read it, you're only agreeing to that one. You're not only agreeing to that one, you're also agreeing to anything that they change in the future. And of course, they change these things quite frequently. And then the final one, of course, is if things mess up, then it's not our problem. Have a nice day. So we talked about EULAs being lengthy, and some of the items I found on the web that underscore that. The Apple EULA is 7,000 plus words, and even Apple reckons that it would probably take you 30 minutes to read the whole thing. The agreement for Adobe Reader is even bigger. It's 9,000 words. And there's a picture somewhere of somebody with holding a 30-foot long printout of the terms of service for using iTunes. And I love this one. Worst of all, it's Microsoft, 15,000 words. So long, it would qualify as a novella if it were fiction. They really are long, and it's a real problem because of that. And as we said, there are some strange clauses, and Chris has got a whole bunch of examples of things that are quite weird.
These were kind of interesting, yeah. iTunes, if you're in the in the side gig of you've got a chemical weapon or biological weapon factory that you're running, you're not allowed to use iTunes because part of the EULA says that you're prohibited from doing that if you're producing nuclear missiles or whatever. Kind of odd. Next.
Yeah, that's going to be a problem for me. That's why I don't use iTunes.
Yeah, exactly. PC Pit Stop. I mentioned about this one, but I didn't have the exact details on it when I mentioned it last week. So in PC Pit Stop, they actually put in a clause in the EULA saying that financial compensation will be awarded to a limited number of people who contact PC Pit Stop at the given email address. And it took over 4 months and over 3,000 downloads before somebody actually wrote at that email address, and they actually got a $1,000 prize for doing so. So I thought that was kind of interesting and real proof that, yeah, people don't read EULAs. At least those 3,000 people didn't. Next.
And real proof that you should read the EULA.
Maybe, yeah. Tumblr. Tumblr is concerned about people going in and hoarding Tumblr usernames on the site. I don't know what for what reason, but Tumblr's EULA says that you're not allowed to hoard them and things like that. And then it gets into some really strange things that you might want to, or some they think people might want to do with Tumblr usernames, like ingest, get drunk on, cyber with, or grope Tumblr usernames. Really odd that their lawyers would actually let them put that into the EULA. Next. And GameStation, this was on April Fool's Day in 2010, they actually put in their EULA for that day that they, if you agree, you gave them a non-transferable option to claim your immortal soul. Next. Now, this was one of the most egregious ones out there. This goes way, way back. But this is one tiny part of 37 sections in an EULA for a program called Flash Talk PC. So what are some of the terms that you're agreeing to in this section? So without any prior notice to you, it's going to do what? Display advertisements for people who pay a fee to Better Internet, that company. So it's adware. Next. It'll store non-personally identifiable statistics of the websites you've visited, so it's going to track you. Next. It'll redirect certain US URLs, including your browser default 404 error page, certain URLs. So maybe if I tried to go to, I don't know, Amazon, it's going to redirect me to their online store or something. I don't know. Next. Provide advertisements, links, and information in response to search terms you use at third-party websites. So they're going to track what you're doing elsewhere and provide you with advertisements based on what you're doing elsewhere. Next. Automatically update the software, include new features, and do it all conveniently without your input or interaction. So they're going to change the software at any time, and they're not going to tell you that it's happening in advance of it. You just get the changes. Next.
Oh, but at least it's convenient.
Yeah, of course, yeah. They'll install desktop icons and installation files, so they're going to install any extra stuff they feel like it. Next. Install software from their affiliates, so they're going to install their friends' stuff. Next. And if that's not enough, install third-party software. So basically install anyone's stuff. So if you agreed to this FlashTalk PC EULA and let it install on your computer, you are basically handing over your computer to these people and letting them do whatever they wanted on your computer. Now, I do have to mention, though, that I don't think that in most cases they're really going to do malicious stuff on your computer. The really malicious actors, they're not going to ask your permission. They're just going to do it, right? So the very fact that they even put it in an EULA tells me that they perhaps have some degree of honor about them, or that they do care about what happens. But at any rate, it is interesting that, you know, you agree to this FlashTalk PC being installed on your computer. You let them do, if they decided to, whatever they want on your computer.
And my next slide says it doesn't have to be this way. As you know, I'm a big fan of open source software, and typically that's done under the GPL, the GNU General Public License. And you see here from the title page that this is a copyleft license. So copyleft, it means that the software is copyrighted, But instead of restricting your rights, like normal copyright, this one uses copyright to actually protect the free nature of the software. So that's why they call it copyleft, because it's the exact opposite, essentially, of copyright. And basically, you get a number of rights, and the rights are pretty straightforward. You can download the software, you can run the software, you can make any changes you want. Remember, this is open source, so you can change the source code. You can redistribute copies of the original program. You can modify and distribute copies of new versions of the software. So it's free to use and free to give away to other people. sorry, I did something there. What did it? Oh, but, right. So you get all these rights, but there is one limitation. And the limitation is essentially, if you modify the software and then you release that modification to the public somehow, then the licensing requires you to make the source code that you've worked on also available to the end users under the same GPL. So that means that you can't take open source software and modify it a little bit and then basically lock it up as proprietary code. And that's what they're trying to prevent here. They're trying to maintain the free use of the open source code. So it's designed, the whole essence of the GPL is it's designed to maintain that the free software remains free. Now that doesn't mean to say that GPL is three or four words. If you look at the license, it's actually 12 pages. There's still 5,000 words in there. But the neat thing about it is, as I said, there's a little bit in there about what rights you get and a whole bunch of stuff about what you can't do with it to protect the free nature of the code. But the really neat thing about GPL is that if you read it once, and I have actually read all 12 pages, and anytime you come across a program which is licensed under GPL, you don't have to go and read the license because it's the same license. So that's really nice, as opposed to, you buy any kind of proprietary software and they have a proprietary EULA, and then you're stuck with, reading the 20 or 40 pages of stuff. Of course, nobody does that. So there's this neat website called Terms of Service Didn't Read, TOSDR. And I think Stuart pointed this one out a while ago. And he says, I've read and agreed to the terms, and it's the biggest lie on the web. Nobody reads anything, essentially. So they have a bunch of canned services that they've looked at, but you can also search for something. So I put in Google just to see what it said, and Google basically got a grade E, got a failing grade, and because of all kinds of stuff here, whereas DuckDuckGo got a grade A because it doesn't track you and so on and so forth. So at least it gives you some idea of what one of these products actually does. Now, the other thing you can do is actually you can go and look for free software that will analyze the EULA. And if you go to this Groovy Post posting, you'll find a download for EULAizer. And EULAizer has been around for quite a long time. I remember playing with this a long time ago. And I think the latest version is dated 2012, but it still works. It runs on Windows 10, no problem. So I downloaded and installed it. And here is my installation folder for TeamViewer. And you can see that there's a bunch of HTML files, which are all EULAs in different languages. And here's the English EULA as an HTML file. So if I open that, then I get a web listing, web page listing inside a browser. I can basically control A to copy all of that text and then drop it into the EULA window here. There's another way to do it. You can hit plus sign here and and grab the text from the screen somewhere, but I think it's just as easy to cut and paste the text from one place to another. So once the text is in the window, you can click on the Analyze key, and it goes through and it flags all of the things that it thinks you should be aware of. And here it's flagging a whole bunch of third-party software things. And if you click on one of these little green arrows here, then it will pop up the text and tell you what it's complaining about. And basically, if you go back to the original URL and find the paragraph that they're complaining about, here's the text. And I think this is the problem right here. It may enable applications of third-party software to communicate with servers provided by TeamViewer and others. So there's some kind of feedback going on here, which you either want or you don't want. It's up to you to decide whether you can live with these restrictions, I guess. Another one, Chris is always big on power toys, so I thought I'd have a look at a Microsoft product. And here's the license. It's actually an MIT license for Microsoft Power Toys. And you might notice that it's pretty short. It's basically like two paragraphs in there. You can probably read all that. But if you go through the analyzer will tell you the license agreement has a low calculated interest identification, so it's not there's nothing of issue in there. It's fairly short, and there were no detected interesting words or phrases. So the MIT license is actually a good license to use. And the fact that Microsoft are using it, well, it has to be a miracle. That's the only thing I can think of. And then finally, this is an article from a journalist with The Guardian, the English newspaper. And he took on the job of not doing anything for a whole week unless he'd read all of the terms and conditions before he did anything. So he spent a whole week, read 146,000 words, and you can read the article, but he basically concludes that you can read the terms and conditions, but it doesn't really help you. His advice is just carry on, don't bother reading it, click on agree, and just hope you don't sign away your firstborn by doing so. They really are long and obscure, and I often try to skim them, but it's still a real pain in the neck to have to do that.
The bottom line is, if you want to run the software, you have to agree to it. So
that's right. Yeah,
I mean, it might be interesting to know what you're agreeing to, but the long and short of it is, if you want to run the software, yeah, you have to click I agree.
And you can always look at reviews and hope somebody will turn stuff up if it's really bad.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along. Chris has got a rant, a Chris rant.
I hate to have to do these, but at any rate, Microsoft Edge version 1.11 was released on February 16th. And lo and behold, there's a new Bing Discover icon on the toolbar. And you know it's a Discover icon only because if you hover the mouse over it, you do get a tooltip that actually will show up there. But there is a very annoying behavior about it, and there was no easy way to remove that new Bing Discover icon. Next. So here it is. We're on the web page, the OPCUG website, and you can see that the Discover icon is in the top left corner of the page, or just off the page. Next. And if you make the mistake of just hovering the mouse cursor over that for less than a second, it actually responds to mouse over events. You don't have to click on it. You just hover over it. All of a sudden, this huge pane covers up the right side of the web page with crap that I bet most people have absolutely no interest in having access to. Next.
You mean you're telling people don't want to know the pros and cons of telling pet vacuum cleaners?
Oh, God. Okay, so the first thing you have to do is close Microsoft Edge. And when I say close Microsoft Edge, next. No, you really have to close Microsoft Edge, all instances of it. You can be guaranteed that there will be multiple instances of it running, most of them as hidden windows. Next. So, oh, actually, before I go on this, I think in my testing going back and forth, I didn't actually have to close Microsoft Edge, but a couple of places I read about this, they did say that you had to do this to successfully get rid of that Discover icon. So I'm including it anyways, but you may find that you can get by without this, but not a bad idea to know how to do this anyways. If you right click the taskbar and choose Task Manager from the context menu that pops up next.
Well, Stuart says he's hovering, but nothing's popping up.
Interesting. I had it that it always was a mouse over event, that it would actually come up. Interesting.
Carry on.
So once Task Manager loads, there's a search box at the top. If you type in Edge next, down in the main body, you'll see the things that include Edge in them. And so you right-click on Microsoft Edge next, and you choose End Task. And you can see in this case here, I had actually 7 instances of Microsoft Edge actually running on the computer. So you click End Task, and it'd kill all of those processes. Next. So then how do you actually fix it? So you have to use registry editors. So you click the start button, you type in regedit, and as soon as you see registry editor come up under the best match, you select that. Click on it or hit enter, and it'll load. Now, a caution, if you're unfamiliar with registry editor, be careful. There is no undo button in the registry editor, and make sure you follow instructions very carefully. Incorrect changes to the registry can definitely break Windows. So what I'm going to point out through all of this, you're adding a registry key and a value to that key. Adding things to the registry almost never will cause any sort of real problem. Modifying existing stuff, if you don't know what you're modifying, very bad thing to do. So just follow instructions carefully or ask somebody to help you out. Next.
And Tom's suggesting creating a restore point before you make any changes.
Yeah, not a bad idea, for sure.
Or a backup.
Yeah. Next. Okay, so when it loads, you navigate in the left-hand pane, and you do that through each of those chevrons that you see can expand out to another area. So you go computer, HK local machine, software, policies, and Microsoft. And then you next right-click on where it says Microsoft in that entire string there, you see in the hierarchy, you have Microsoft. And so you right-click on that, you choose New Key, Next. And then you name the key Edge. And just like creating a new folder in File Explorer, when you say New Folder, you'll actually get a folder called New Folder, and it's highlighted, so you can just start typing over top of it to name the key Edge. If you accidentally leave it named whatever its default name is, you can right-click on it and choose Rename. And so you want to name it Edge. Next. And then on the right-hand side, you right-click in the pane anywhere in the empty space, and you select New DWORD 32-bit Value, and then you name that Hubs Sidebar Enabled. And it should be exactly put in exactly the way you see it there with case sensitive and everything like that. Next. So now we have the value there that's named Hub Sidebar Enabled. Next. And the default for new 32-bit DWORD values is zeros. Okay, so the default data value of zero is exactly what you want. Leave it at that in order to do this disabling the Bing icon in Edge. Next. Now, I found that it happened automatically. If I loaded Edge, the icon was gone. There were some indications that some people said that there was an additional step that you actually have to do. So I'm including it here in case you still end up with the Discover icon in Edge. Go into Edge, and in the URL bar, you type in edge:// policy, and it'll load the page that you see there. Next. And you click on the reload policies, and next. The Discover icon is gone. And so if you don't want the Bing Discover icon, that's how you can get rid of it. Paul Thurrott in particular, who also ranted about this and thought that Microsoft was going its typical insane way of foisting things on people, he suspects that it actually is going to be a configurable item within Edge quite easily at a future iteration of all of this, that Microsoft will come a bit to their senses and give us a way to get rid of it without going through a registry editor.
It's interesting, though, Chris. It seems as though not everybody sees this. Stuart says it doesn't, and Linda says she found the same thing.
Yeah, that is interesting. Now, it could be that they've already made changes to its action, that maybe the mouse over is no longer the way that it acts, because Edge gets updated on a very frequent basis. And so it could be that they had too many complaints about the mouse over just making it all of a sudden active. So maybe they've already changed that.
Aaron says, especially, what's the problem if you don't hover over it?
Especially the fact that you have to go across it to get to the X. If you were close, like that must just drive you crazy, because that's the pathway to the X.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the answer to the question, right? What's the problem if you don't hover over it?
Yeah, I guess it's just a Paul Thurrott complained about it being an ugly icon that he didn't want there and wasn't ever going to use, and so why should he have to have it in his face? And to a certain extent, I agree with him on that. But if they have done away with the mouse over effect, then that's its most egregious aspect of it is gone, so maybe it's easier to just leave it there.
And Tim says he hopes you don't have to do it for every update.
Well, yeah, that's question two, is that whether Microsoft would overwrite that registry key and force it back on you. They've been known to do that.
And Jess says, wouldn't it be nice if there was an easy way to simply uninstall Edge?
Yeah, Paul Thurrott tweeted today, he retweeted something from Microsoft that said, please tell us what is the one feature of Edge that you simply couldn't live without. And Paul Thurrott replied and said, the ability to use Edge to download Brave.
Okay. Right, we're inside that last 10, so if anybody has any other questions or things that you want to comment on, now is your opportunity. Tom's got some comments in here about the new version of Bing and I guess the adoption of ChatGPT.
That Bing Discover button actually opens up a ChatGPT. For Microsoft, it's similar, I guess, to Google Assistant. I've never used it yet, but people may like to actually play with it rather than throw it away immediately.
All you got to do is go to Bing.com, and you'll get ChatGPT is available through there.
I have a. Can you hear me? I'm not sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, we can't hear you at all.
I have a perhaps a relevant question, or not for this topic, but just in case. Somebody asked me to put something on Facebook, an announcement about an upcoming event, but they don't have a Facebook page. Is there some way to put something on Facebook that's not on a specific page other than something like Marketplace where you essentially you're selling something?
Just create an event and then invite all your friends. That seems to be the simplest way.
Sorry, I didn't understand what you said.
You can create an event.
Yes.
And then put some details in and then invite all your friends.
Okay. And how do you create an event on Facebook?
I've done it before.
So is it on the Facebook page or is it on the main Facebook?
It's on Facebook.com.
It'd be under your profile or whatever that it would end up.
Yes.
And will other people, like, it's an event that I don't have anything to do with. So
yeah. I understand what it is. You're trying to create something that is completely divorced from your presence on Facebook.
Yeah.
I don't think there'd be any way to do that. So if the person wants to do that, they'd have to create a Facebook account.
Their own Facebook account.
They're very
very lazy.
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's the case.
Great, thanks.
Two says hacks, by the way. Is there anywhere that you can, any kind of public websites where you can just post events like that?
You could post it on any forum. Facebook, if you post it on Facebook, then you can invite all your friends. You could send it to the newspapers.
There's Eventbrite, where, again, you'd have to create an account there. But once you create an account, you can create events on Eventbrite that people, if they're searching for things, if you, you know, keyword it properly and things like that, anybody searching for whatever event it is that you're trying to set up, they would find it and be able to get the details.
Okay. It's a stamp club or a stamp group, and it's basically all older people, and they're trying to figure out a way to get some interest from the younger people, and that's what they thought that might work. But I think that's probably not.
Things like Eventbrite, I mean, you can do it for free as long as you're not charging for the event. And so all it takes is a bit of time to post it. And who knows if it'll generate any interest or not. We used to post our meetings on Eventbrite, but we didn't think that we were really getting anything from it. So, we basically stopped doing that.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
And Tim's suggesting maybe look at Reddit, which is an open forum. And Karen's suggesting Meetup, which is a way to post various kind of events for people.
Yes, I've heard of that. Okay. Yeah, good.
Or Kijiji events.
Okay.
Okay, well, I think we've covered everything that's been in the chat there, so... We're at the witching hour, so let me just remind people that if you are not currently a member, if you give us $20 right now for the current year's membership, we'll give you a second year's membership absolutely free. So you're going to get 2 years for two membership years for the price of one. And if you're currently a member, then don't worry about it, because on April the 1st, your membership expiry will be automatically extended by a year at no cost to you. So please don't send us money. We don't really want it from you. our next regular club meeting, monthly meeting, is in April the 12th. And it's going to be Stefan Richard, and he's going to be talking about computer. It's all about the bits. So everything you want to know about ones and zeros in computing, we will hear about on April the 12th. Our May meeting is going to be members' favorites, and we really need some input. So people who want to give presentations should give us a heads up in terms of what it's going to be, and we'll put you on the list. If nobody signs up, it's either going to be a short meeting or you're going to be stuck with Chris and I again. And I'll just mention one more meeting. The schedule is full until December, but we are looking for a topic and a speaker for the December meeting, which will be December the 13th. So if you want to take that on, or you know somebody that might be a possibility, then that would be a great help. And just a reminder that the board's one short right now, and we're looking for somebody to take on that job of program chair. And you've only got one task for this whole year, is filling in that December meeting. So that's a good deal, I think. Okay, finally, next week, next Wednesday, the 29th, will be our regular Q&A session. So we're looking for your questions and your shares and anything you want to provide, send it to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we'll be happy to receive all your input. So that's it from me. I think we're done. I hope everybody enjoyed the multiple things we had tonight, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for coming, folks. See you next week.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Arrivederci.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.
Well, I had a sincere idea to mention it.